Welcome to The Scope, the podcast of Gastroenterology and Endoscopy News. Today, Dr. Dave Robbins and I are speaking with Dr. Klaus Mergener, who is the president of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, and he also is a PhD. His PhD is in molecular virology from Heidelberg University. Klaus, thanks so much for joining us today. What is molecular virology?
Yeah, thank you, Adam, and welcome, everyone. It's glad to be with you all. I appreciate the invite. Well, what I did after my MD is essentially spend a couple of years in a lab in Germany working on molecular biology aspects of viruses. So what it really is trying to figure out the different components of viruses, not just the genome, but also the entire assembly of viral particles and such. And my own PhD had to do with evaluating the spike protein, you might call it GP120, of the AIDS virus, HIV, long time ago.
Klaus, we're fascinated by your ability to speak about virus transmission and in particular how it could relate to the practicing gastroenterologist. So I'm really looking forward to diving into this with you. You know, it's said that history repeats itself and can inform us about the future. And SARS-CoV-2 is similar in many ways to other coronaviruses. So with that in mind, what can we extrapolate? What can we anticipate based on what we know from other members of the family?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a few things I believe we can probably learn from other coronaviruses. Just to explain to our listeners briefly, coronaviruses have been known for a long time. I think they were first discovered in the 1930s, so initially in animals, and then the first ones in humans in the 1960s. And currently, as we're sitting here, there's four human coronaviruses that are the cause of essentially a common cold illness. And we've seen two outbreaks in the last two decades, with two additional coronaviruses that caused initially the first SARS outbreak in 2003, and then an outbreak in the Middle East with the MERS virus. So that group of six viruses has been known for a while and has been studied quite well. And what's common to all of them and the new SARS-CoV-2 virus is they are respiratory viruses. So they infect mostly epithelial cells in the respiratory tract and are spread in the same fashion, we believe, mostly through respiratory transmission. And we can probably get into the details there in a little bit more detail in a moment. The current virus, if I may add real quickly, is also different. And we know this already after only 4 months of the new virus having been discovered. It's quite different from the first SARS virus in that while they're both respiratory viruses, we know that the 2003 outbreak was relatively limited in part because patients didn't really become infectious themselves until they had developed significant symptoms. They were quite ill by the time they made a lot of viruses and then started shedding them. Whereas with the current virus, uniquely, after becoming infected, the viral load will very quickly go up, and oftentimes before the index case, before the infected patient becomes symptomatic, meaning you can produce a lot of virus before you even know that you have the disease and therefore can pass it on before you develop your own symptoms.
Right. And so it's these asymptomatic shedders, so to speak, that I think are the real pain point for us as we figure out how to reopen. So if you can shed virus and not have symptoms, and if current molecular testing is only about 60 to maybe 70% sensitive, how are we going to find a path forward to safely do procedures?
It's going to be a real dilemma for quite some time. I mean, eventually, we're all hoping and expecting that we will have a vaccine, of course, and therefore a way of protecting essentially our entire population. But until we get there, and the best predictions that I have heard still would suggest that it's going to be another year, maybe even a bit longer off until we have a vaccine. Until we get to that point, and until we have more robust data on testing, as you suggest, I think it'll come down to protecting ourselves and taking measures in our endoscopy centers to decrease the likelihood both of patient-to-patient transmission and of transmission between patients and providers.
Yeah, and there seems to be a gathering understanding of a dose or an exposure response relationship, which is to say that the doctor in the emergency room is not only more likely to get infected, but to have a more severe course than perhaps the endoscopist, who may even be unknowingly scoping a COVID positive patient, but using an N95 mask. Do you think that that makes any kind of sense?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to it. Once we dive into that topic, it becomes quite complex. I would take a step back and first of all consider how is the virus being transmitted exactly. So we talked briefly about the fact that current projections suggest that about 45% of all infection transmissions happen before the patient himself or herself becomes symptomatic. So that's our first hurdle. And then most of these transmissions, in terms of the route of transmitting the virus, are assumed to happen through respiratory droplets. So those are bigger droplets of material that the patient would cough and expel. And that is still, I believe, felt to be the main route of transmission. There's a lot of debate currently in the literature and studies that are not quite agreeing with each other in terms of whether or not you can also exhale this virus and spread it by simple breathing, meaning without coughing or retching or anything.
Right.
That is quite controversial. It seems the minor route. And then for us gastroenterologists, there was a lot of discussion weeks ago and still some ongoing about could this virus be transmitted via fecal oral transmission. And that's an important point to maybe just spend an extra 30 seconds on where that came from and is still being considered is from studies that have looked at virus RNA in the stool. And you can clearly find significant amounts of coronavirus RNA in the stool of infected patients. There's little doubt. To my knowledge, there's still not a single study showing that viable virus, infectious virus, is being excreted and then spread through the stool. There's one report that everyone cites indirectly from the Chinese CDC, supposedly reporting in Chinese a case report of a single patient where virus could be cultured from the stool, but that's, to my knowledge, the only time. So to sum that up, it seems to be that coughing and when aerosol is produced from the lungs, essentially, that's the route of transmission, meaning that then also becomes our main concern as endoscopists when we're getting near patients and do, say, an upper endoscopy and they start coughing while I am putting the scope down, then I do need to be concerned that that's a high-risk area, so to speak, and need to protect myself.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because there is a clear distinction, as you pointed out, between molecular evidence and a live variant. And as you pointed out, the studies and the concern around aerosolization in the absence of overt coughing or gagging are really just extrapolating based on molecular particle evidence and not even necessarily of COVID. Is that right?
That's an excellent point. That's exactly right. And it goes even one step further. There's additional studies then looking at where else might you find that RNA, that virus RNA. There's a study, as an example, from the Nebraska Medical Center of rooms, hospital rooms, that were used to treat COVID patients. And they essentially did little swipes and wipe downs of different corners and places in that room. And they showed in that study that they can find SARS-CoV-2 viral RNA on the windowsill, underneath the bed, in all kinds of corners of the room, more than 2 or 3 meters away from a patient. But again, all that shows essentially is that over time, viral RNA accumulates in some corner of the room. It doesn't tell us anything about whether or not that's actually a significant risk for acquiring the virus. So it's a very important distinction that I think all of us, as we're reading new papers as they come out, have to keep in mind. Are they talking about a virus seen in true tissue culture, or are they simply talking about RNA detection?
Right. Okay. That is actually very, very reassuring to hear. So I wanted to ask you along this concept of virus particle size. We talk about N95s. They get their name from being able to filter out 95% of particles greater than 300 nanometers in size. So number one, what about that other 5%? And then number two, the coronavirus only is thought to be about 100 nanometers in diameter. To what extent can we really expect to have protection from these N95 type masks?
Yeah, that's, again, an excellent question. And not being a mechanical engineer, as none of us are, I can only tell you the way I am looking at this and rationalizing this. So as you correctly said, N95, the name comes from a laboratory test, essentially, with non-viral particles, just different size particles, and they're looking at filtration rates. So essentially what that indicates, first of all, is a certain level of filtration rate. And you might compare this to surgical masks, where the pore size of the mask is almost 1,000 times larger than the pore size of an N95. So one would first recognize, yes, this is a tighter filter, if you will. And therefore, intuitively, it makes sense to me that more would get filtered. Now, in terms of whether or not that, you know, does that then catch viruses, all viruses, viruses that are smaller than potentially the pore size of this mask? I think it's almost too simplistic to think about it in this term. Realize when they quote pore sizes, or in the case of N95, 95% of a particle size of a certain size will get filtered. That's a statistical average, as is the pore size. The pore size in a mask is not always exactly the same, nor is the diameter that's quoted in studies for certain viruses. I've seen for SARS-CoV-2 diameters quoted between 80 nanometers and about 200. So it's probably the case that this is not a round virus and a round hole, and some of this really gets filtered if the pore size is only small enough. But it may also very well be that we're not talking about this virus getting filtered out even with a 95 mask completely. I think the main point is that intuitively, we would have to think this mask is better than a surgical mask. And if I could add one more point that I found very interesting looking at the literature related to surgical masks and N95s, they have been tested in the past on other respiratory viruses, so influenza as an example. And there have been, even if you can believe it, a small number of studies that have tested them comparatively, the two types, masks and respirator, on volunteers and looked at will they get infected afterwards wearing an N95 versus a surgical mask. It's interesting that those studies, again, not done on corona, but on other viruses, have not been very consistent. Meaning, if you asked me, do I have solid scientific data to show you that an N95 works very well for any viral infection, I would have to tell you I'm not aware of that kind of study. I think a lot of what we're currently doing, we're basing on our intuition that it seems to be, hopefully, will protect us more. But that point we should all remember. And I would say in general terms, you can extrapolate that to any protective equipment, not just masks, but also, you know, do we really need to wear face shield or a head cover or shoe cover? How much incremental protection is that going to provide? I think the short answer is we don't know. If we don't know, let's err on the safe side.
Right, right. Okay, so I want to ask you a question that I've been thinking about, but was too afraid to ask anyone else. So I'm going to ask you. So we know that the virus is reliant on the ACE2 receptor to get a hold and cause an infection. And yet we're told by the CDC and others, whatever you do, don't touch your face. So let's say I touch my cheek and then my fingertips have COVID on it. How is it going to get from my cheek into my lung?
That's right. It has to do with these little legs underneath the virus, and it's going to crawl in from your cheek.
Right.
No, very good question. I think we would have to assume that simply touching your cheek or any other part of your body away from the epithelial cells that are known to be the target cells for viral infection is not going to do it. So you would eventually have to transfer it, to smear it, or to directly deposit the next time you touch with the same hand your face, directly deposit it close enough to your nostrils or into your nose, hopefully not, but who knows, or into your mouth to then get it to the posterior pharynx. So I don't think touching your cheeks is going to do it, but it brings up an excellent point. I mean, once again, all of these issues that we're currently wrestling with, you know, how dangerous is it? Could virus be deposited on my little processor or screen or any equipment behind me, and then I touch it with my glove and I get it to my gown, and then I take my protective equipment off, and lo and behold, a little bit of virus gets on my hand, and then it gets into the nose. You know, how important is that route of infection compared to a patient coughing me in the face?
Right.
We have no way of quantifying it. Again, I would tell you intuitively, to me, it makes sense that all of these other mechanisms are a relatively small percentage of the infection risk. And the main risk is really the patient's mouth and a forcefully expelled by coughing or forceful breathing amount of air and droplets. Also meaning, therefore, that that's where I need to really focus on. So I want to stay that 6 feet away from a patient as much as I can. Or if I can't do it during an upper endoscopy, I want to wear really complete protective gear. And then I want to be extra careful washing my hands every time that I have a chance or use hand sanitizer. So that's more important to focus on, I think, that high-risk zone, if you will. You might imagine a 2 meter, 6 feet zone around the patient is really the high risk area, and coughing is the main mechanism to transfer the virus.
Okay, that's helpful, because there are many times during the day when I inadvertently do touch my face, and then I have to go take a Xanax, and I reach my maximum dose of anti-anxiety medication very quickly.
I will tell you that may actually also be a mechanism why surgical masks aren't all such a bad idea. Even if we say, well, you know, if there was a lot of virus in the air, can you breathe it through a surgical mask, large pore size and such? The answer probably is yes. But it's a great reminder whenever I wear one,
right.
Usually touch around my mouth when there's a surgical mask in front of me. As a matter of fact, every so often I grab my coffee cup and try to get it to my mouth and reminded I can't drink coffee right now. So,
right.
You know, in that sense, a surgical mask actually is a great help, because otherwise we touch our face so often and so frequently one way or the other, that you have a hard time not doing it, and you would have to take a lot of Xanax over the course of a day.
Okay, one more question. I wanted to talk to you about room aeration and room exchange times. You know, on the one hand, we're advising that any patient who's known to be COVID positive, that procedure, especially an upper endoscopy, get performed in a negative pressure room. But the vast majority of ASCs across the country don't have such capabilities. So given the fact that there will be asymptomatic shedders in our units, what's the best way to conceptualize or get our arms around minimum aeration times, room turnover, and by extension, room efficiency?
Yes, and I was afraid you would ask me that question, because my short answer to it is, I think this is an area that is really very key to all of us, and also an area where we have very little, if any, intelligible data. We need a whole lot more information about it. We are seeing recommendations from a variety of sources, not the GI professional societies just yet, but other groups, suggesting that one should add extra aeration time for procedure rooms in between individual procedures. I do not believe that the times that are being quoted, and I have seen, you know, anywhere between 5 minutes and 30 minutes or even longer between procedures, I don't know that any of these times are based on any studies that specifically look at endoscopy rooms. And I also don't know that we can easily compare, even if there is data, from other environments such as OR rooms, because you have different airflows, you have different, you know, types of patients in the ICU or the OR compared to an outpatient ASC. So I think we have virtually nothing to base this on, except for the basic information we talked about the last few minutes, that if we assume there may be some patients that are infected that are entering our ASC, and we might be doing an upper endoscopy on them, and they're coughing in this room during their procedure, and now we're done with their procedure and taking them out of the room, there may be a few minutes, but I'm completely unable to quantify that, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, where a cloud expelled from that patient might still be floating around, if you want to picture this in the room.
Right.
Now, how is aeration then going to help? I would give you two competing scenarios. Maybe just opening the doors is good. Is that much more airflow? Does that really help in the absence of any new, you know, ventilators that you would install into the room? Just opening the doors, is that going to do much? If there really is more airflow, then what about the thought that, well, maybe you're resuspending virus that had already settled to the floor, if you will, into the air? So I'm not even sure that pushing air in or sucking it out is going to help or hurt the virus concentration in the air around the actual procedure area. So that's a long-winded way of saying I really don't know that these recommendations are based on anything. And I personally am not convinced that extra aeration time is going to significantly reduce the risk of infection. Now, I will qualify this with one last sentence, and this holds true for our entire podcast here, that what I told you in all of these questions and answers is my personal opinion. I'm not presenting here any specific GI society, but it's really just my personal thoughts in terms of how to approach it.
Understood. Yeah, and we're going to check back with you, because I think the answers will change probably next week. But that was tremendously helpful, Klaus. I'm going to let Adam take over, and we'll probably close out.
Klaus, thanks so much for joining us today. One of the common threads in this conversation has been the amount of uncertainty in pretty much everything we know about the virus. When you look around and see this enormous rush to publish studies in preprint servers and in peer-reviewed journals, have you been impressed or alarmed by anything in particular? Are we rushing to get things out that maybe shouldn't be out? I'm thinking particularly of one study about hydroxychloroquine that came out of France, which now is an expression of concern. What's your sense about the state of the literature now?
That's an excellent question, and it's certainly true, I think, for all of us that we're seeing this flood of not just early studies, but also commentaries, letters to editors, you know, personal opinions being published. And first of all, it's very hard to keep up with it and find enough time to sit down if you're seeing a headline that particularly interests you, to then really dive into the paper to try to find out whether or not the research methodology was solid or not solid. I would answer this in two ways. My personal sense was for the first few weeks, first couple of months, there was a flood of these kinds of contributions, and I started getting the feeling that a lot of them were not very good in terms of their quality. What I'm seeing journals do now, and I can in this instance speak specifically for the journal Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, which is the flagship journal of ASG, I see their editorial team led by Michael Wallace be very restrictive and very thoughtful in terms of the submissions that they allow. And so I'm hopeful that that approach is mirrored by many of the other journals, but I share your concern that just because of the sheer volume, for us on the other side, if you will, as readers, it becomes very difficult to sift through that large number and find the few real jewels in the much larger number of submissions. So, the way I personally approach this is to become very selective. If I see a journal or a publication, such as Gastrointestinal and Endoscopy News, where I feel that there's a true sense for filtering out the many submissions that are subpar, and focusing on a few high-quality contributions, those are the publications then that I turn to primarily to get my own reading.
We've been speaking with Dr. Klaus Mergener, the president of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy and a molecular virologist now by hobby, if not by practice. Klaus, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Klaus, and congratulations on your presidency. Look forward to a great year.
Yeah, thank you. It'll be fun.
It's not going to be boring.